This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole network galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Welcome to the Huntivore Podcast, powered by Sportsman's Empire, where we celebrate the hunting and fishing lifestyle through the utilization and consumption of our wild game. No egos.
Fork in hand, beer in the other.
No status.
A piece of red meat on a hot grill and turn it into a burnt offering.
Just catch it, cut it, cook it.
The end of football camp. So that's why I'm in the back of my truck right now, is I'm pulling like super suburban dad. I've already gone and done the grocery shopping. I dropped the kids off. And so like I had like an hour of time. The wife's been like, hey, go pick this up from this person because I bought something on Marketplace. So I ran and did that. And so now it's like, okay, nothing more. I got a podcast. So we got to get this thing in here. But that's kind of been the start of my summer is – I've wanted to get into a whole bunch of stuff. I really want to get out foraging. I really want to get out and be in the outdoors. Problem is like, man, my family's calling and it's just pulling me in totally different directions. So hearing that you've been doing a little bit of work on your property down.
Okay, so turkey season was a really good season. I killed two really good birds, one in Mississippi and one in Louisiana.
Did it go really well for you?
And if any of your listeners know anything about hunting,
kind of just get the property ready for
the most challenging turkeys on the planet. They're hunted by everybody. Thick terrain, swampy terrain. So, you know, to be successful in Louisiana is, you know, is impressive. I can't remember the last time I've tagged out. We're allowed two tags in Louisiana. And the last couple of years, I've only been able to fill one, but happy to fill the one. Good. And they were both really good birds, man. Both 10.5-inch beard pluses, really good spurs. So both exciting hunts. I had encounters with both birds prior to me killing them. So I had a little bit of history with each bird. So I couldn't be happier with turkey season. Again, very pleased with turkey season. But, you know, I'm mad at them. I hate when the season ends and I'm ready for the next season. I'd prefer hunting turkey over any other animal. So that's just the way it goes. And I'm like that every turkey season. I'm like, dang it, man. You know, I only get 6 weeks to hunt them, and it drives me nuts.
Yeah. Is what makes those birds the hardest to hunt that you find in the United States? Is it numbers? Or is it like you said, is it like the time available?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lot of things. Like, you know, the turkey population has been dwindling. I don't think there's as many birds to hunt in Louisiana.
Or 3D
I think the birds that are there are extremely pressured. You know, I think they're always on the run. They're being hunted by, you know, other predators other than humans. They're being hunted by a lot of humans. And I believe our season is too late. You know, the Louisiana season opens the first weekend in April, and I was on a deer stand in February and listening to turkeys gobble. So, I mean, you know, they're gobbling in February, you know, and we're hunting them 2 months later. So I think it's a combination of all that, probably mostly just a decline in turkey population. You know, and that can be attributed to by a lot of different things, the increase in feral hogs. The increase in raccoons, now that raccoon pelts have gone to almost nothing, you know, people just stopped trapping them. so there's a plethora of raccoons, and, you know, they're nest raiders. When a raccoon finds a turkey nest, it doesn't just eat one egg, it eats all of them. So the whole clutch goes away, and, you know, with the influx of raccoons, it's really difficult for a hen to keep a whole clutch and for them to grow up to be, you know, a huntable turkey.
That numbers, just like you were saying, those numbers and those raccoons, like, as much as your numbers are already coming down, like, there's no reprieve. Even the hens that do make it, they're then ambushed by those raiders right away. So it is a double-edged sword down there for you guys.
It really is. And then, you know, I saw a list, you know, even so much as fire ants are turkey egg predators. So I don't see how a turkey makes it at all, quite honestly, you know, and they're so vulnerable as a poult to everything. You know, every predator out there is after them, including the avian predators, owls and hawks and, you know, eagles and everything else that we've got. Everything's after them. I just don't understand, you know, the poor things just don't stand a chance. And then they get big enough and we shoot them in the face.
Oh, man, the life of a thunder chicken is just, you know, it ain't no rest for the wicked. The cards it's dealt, man. But I think testament to the bird. Holy smokes, it can live, it can thrive through that. It can have another generation, may it be a little bit smaller, but with the cards are stacked against it, it finds a way.
Yep.
Has there been a lot, I mean, has there been a lot of work by either the National Wild Turkey Federation? Has there been co-ops that have really started to work in on Louisiana? Or is it one of those things like, well, we'll just try to keep reintroducing to see if that takes hold. But is there a lot of work going on to help that habitat or to bring down? Because you said those pelts for those raccoons means it's meaningless. It's nothing right now. It's just seems like almost the only thing going for it is going to be the avid turkey hunter trying to protect them.
And I think the avid turkey hunter is, you know, we're not just turkey hunters. We're outdoorsmen for the most part. I don't think I've ever come across somebody who just turkey hunts. You know, we deer hunt, we fish, we do all the things. But here locally, it's been mostly self-governed. We started a huge trapping program on both the properties that I hunt, in which case one of the properties, which is about 7,500 acres, we culled out about 300 raccoons about 2 years ago, and also culled out about 300 feral hogs, which is another thing all on its own. Both of them are, you know, just tremendous turkey predators. But so we've done that ourselves. I haven't seen anything from the Wild Turkey Federation as far as, you know, helping with conservation. It's all been, you know, the turkey hunter themselves getting out there and trying to make a better living for them. I'd like to see the Wild Turkey Federation come out here and do, you know, education, trapping education, prescribed fire burns, whatever it may take to get them that way. But, you know, they can only do so much. They can't prevent, you know, flooding in South Louisiana. You know, they can't prevent, you know, some of the habitat issues that we have. They can't prevent, you know, a huge neighborhood going up, which, you know, once was a pasture that had, you know, good turkey laying potential. So, you know, and I don't think they get the dollars that, you know, people like Ducks Unlimited get, that type of program. So, yeah, I just don't see it here. I'd like to see it, but I just don't know what more they could do here.
Right. It's like you said right there, boots on the ground. It's going to be the passionate guys that are on the property who are looking to make it as productive as possible. And that's going to be taking out those things, either getting the trapping programs, being on top of those hogs, or, you know, trying to just create more of the habitat that hens can be able to lay that down. You're exactly right. I even here in Michigan, like, I know there's a lot of organizations, and it's, I don't want to say it's necessarily their fault. And, you know, I mentioned that, and maybe that was a little bit unfair, because their big push is to, you know, work their way either through what we call Lansing, or where your state government's going to be at. They're going to be trying to get through legislature to be able to have conservation for these animals. Make sure you got biologists studying what's out there to know what our numbers are going to be, that can we hunt them? What are the how many tags can we issue out per hunter? So there's a lot that I know that they've got to levy. And so now here we are being the ones that are actually doing the hunting, actually the ones boots on the ground. I think that's going to be where a lot of that is going to be won and lost. So I'm glad to hear that on the properties that you are, it's really become a big co-op where it's not on one shoulder. That yoke is being shared amongst all the people that are on that property.
Right. You know, we even go so much, you know, we're at war with coyotes. We pay for a lease. There's about 50 of us that pay for 7,500 acres to hunt. And part of your lease dues are reduced per coyote. So that we have a bounty on coyotes. So if you can kill four coyotes, you know, you knock a couple $100 off your lease dues. So, you know, things like that, you know, and of course, obviously you kill a coyote and it not only helps the turkey population, which is what I'm really interested in, but it also helps, you know, with fawn recruitment and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's one of those things. I'm a big advocate that, you know, they have their place on the landscape. You know, coyotes are an incredible survivor. Raccoons, they are very, very intelligent, very curious, very innovative in how they work. But at the same time, when their numbers aren't checked nearly as much, it's like, well, okay, like, you know, I got to put the love aside. And now we got to work on these numbers.
Hey, it becomes a conservation issue at that point.
Right. I kind of find a little bit of camaraderie with the woodchuck. that is, it's a mighty little tank, but he loves to dig under everything, underneath every fence post, underneath every post that's at our barns that are holding the turkeys up. And so anytime that we get a chance to pop a woodchuck, it's like, bud, you're a great critter, but you can't be here. You
gotta move on. Exactly.
So the 22, actually the dog has been taken after the pups. If we can take out either the big sow and then the pups start to work their way around, the dog has been actually very good at that. He's become quite the ambush predator when it comes to taking out our woodchucks. He's a little bit quicker than we are. So it's been fun to witness that.
Good. A little added, assistance. Never hurt anything.
Absolutely. Well, hey, let's get back to those longbeards that you got. Being that they are an older Tom, or at least they're beyond Jake, what age do you think these are? Do you think they're 3-year-olds with that 10-inch beard, or you think they're older?
Well, I had one that was probably a 4-year-old bird and one that was a 3-year-old bird. They just, extremely difficult to hunt. And, they're not easy to age. You know, and there's a lot of data out there that says, if you look at this, if you look at the spur length, if you look at the beard length, but I don't know if anybody's ever had a concrete answer, unlike, deer, where I can look at a deer's teeth and say, yes, that was a 4-year-old deer. But I believe one of them was, a good 3.5-year-old bird and, one was a 4-year-old bird. Just the way they act, man. And I had one, it was probably the best spurs I've ever had. It was well over a 1/4 inch spurs. And he just did not want to commit. It took me over 1.5 hours, from the first time I heard him to when, I sent pellets down range, to get him in, and he'd break off and I'd call him back in. He'd break off and I'd call him back in. And all this was without ever even seeing the bird. I didn't see the bird until like the last 2 minutes of the hunt. And, so call it 1 hour and 20 minutes or so of just, going back and forth with a turkey call with the guy and never being able to see him. So you can imagine, the anticipation and the excitement and anxiety that I had. And finally, he came up over the ridge and in full strut and saw the decoy. And I'll tell you, the 20-gauge with TSS is just no joke, man. This is my first year with TSS. And it's my first year with a 20-gauge, and I won't go back. I made a shot at about 40 yards and just put the hammer on him, man. I'm a true believer of the TSS. So in the first one, it was a fast hunt. We had an encounter with him the day before in Mississippi, and I just couldn't seal the deal, and we chased him all over Mississippi. And then the next day, we got him right off the roost, and he came in and fired up. And, again, the decoy, I know a lot of people don't like using decoys, but I can honestly say these two birds, I'm not sure I would have gotten either one of them without a decoy. And, again, same thing. Some people love decoys and some people are like, I can do without them. But I'm a believer in a good decoy.
Yep. I know a lot of guys in Michigan, they really enjoy a decoy. Just a hand that's just sitting out in front of it on a little post where the wind will turn her around left and right to give her that realism. A lot of guys are doing that. With that really long hunt that you were talking, trying to bring him in, he'd call a little bit and then you'd have to wait. And finally he would come over that ridge. You think that's part of that? These birds are schooled from a young age as Jake's, as they watch these big toms get smacked by all these hunters. Do you think they remember, like, I'm not quite sure if I want to go into this one. Do you think they're picking up on that?
I think he would just, it was kind of, it ended up being kind of later in the day, or not later in the day, later in the morning, I'd say. I didn't hear him gobble till well after sunrise. So I think he was just the thing that, he was looking for love and he was hungry, and the two kind of, he had the two of them quarreling with inside of him. And every time he'd put his mind on food and try walking away, I'd make him think about love. And then he'd, all right, well, let's go do the love thing. So, seeing the turkey for the first time on that hunt, oh my God, you know, it was intense. And then when you finally see it, you're like, you know, it's breathtaking all of a sudden, like, oh crap, this is probably going to happen. So, you know, I think it was just, you know, a matter of, you know, a decent call. I've been calling now for probably 45 years, with a pot call. So I think I'm pretty good with a pot call. A diaphragm call is a total mystery to me just because I grew up with a pot call. And, you know, as much as good calling, it's knowing when to call. You know, when we first started talking, he and I, I'd give him a call and I'd shut up for about 20 minutes. And I'd give him a call and shut up for a minute. And I'd interrupt him. He'd gobble and I'd interrupt him. And then when I'd figure out that he was trying to walk away, I'd get to, you know, I'd give him the old excited hen and try to get him fired up. And he would. He'd get him fired up and he'd turn around and come back. And then, you know, I just by listening to it, I'd figure that, you know, he kind of lost interest and he was going somewhere else. And I'd get him the excited hen and he'd get excited and make a couple of steps towards me. And, you know, ultimately, you know, the calling overruled evolution, where, you know, evolution's got the hen going to him and him, not him going to the hen. So, you know, I hate to brag on myself, but I think I did a good job of calling that bird in when he wasn't even interested.
That is, I just learned that a couple years ago, that, yeah, it's totally flipped around. Guys are trying to call in these toms when it should be the hens going to the toms.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, we're completely flipping it over, which, I mean, at that point in time, you're like, you know, to be that engaged with the animal itself, that's got to be a whole new highlight. It's turkey hunting. The more that I hear about it from guys like you and from Paul Campbell, it's very exciting stuff. And being a turkey farmer as a young kid, like the excitement of chasing turkeys, I was like, well, I do that every day. But at the same time, being able to hear guys in the wild be able to do that, it's like, you know what, maybe I should give this a shot. Maybe I should, you know, in the springtime, if I ever have free time again, be able to go out and chase those toms. But that sounds like a great, great hunt.
Oh, it was a blast. And it was funny. We went to a farm this weekend. I was picking up some more bees for my farm. And the girl that had the farm had some turkeys on her farm. And they would gobble. And I was like, oh, you know, I was getting excited over domestic turkeys gobbling.
Yeah, they act very much the same, but yeah, it's ours are the big white ones. They wouldn't make it very far outside that building. They like to stay on the inside. Sometimes a fence will even go down and they'll get out for a little bit and they'll enjoy the big grass pasture out there. But then when they're really hungry or they're really wanting that water again, they just walk right back in. They're not going far. They know where their stuff is coming from. So now you got these two big toms. What have you made with them yet? Or are they in the freezer right now and you're still trying to figure out what we're going to, or you've already placed them later in the year as a meal? What plans do you have for these two long beards?
Well, I have cooked them. You know, it's kind of one of those things where it's instant gratification. Cause I'm, you know, at heart, I'm a 5-year-old and I need the instant gratification. So I have cooked some, you know, just fried, But I do plan on doing a turkey roll for Thanksgiving, which was one of the things I set out to do, to make sure that I had at least one breast for Thanksgiving. But my all-time favorite turkey recipe is a wild turkey Tuscan pasta, where I use cream and I'll pre-cook the turkey breast in bite-sized chunks. Add cream, spinach, mushrooms, sun-dried tomatoes. And put it in pasta. And that is my all-time favorite recipe. And I would do that with chicken. I would do that with any white meat, quail, pheasant. But one of my absolute favorite things for turkey.
That pasta pairing, like you just said, I could even think of 100 different ways on even changing up whatever you wanted for your sauce. But like that turkey pasta, it's a great marriage together. Those two work so well.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think about it. You know, it's different than a domestic chicken, but a lot of the chicken recipes, you can use wild turkey. You got to look at it differently. You got to cut it differently, and understand that it is not a chicken. You know, they're much bigger, and it's a wild bird, so they're tougher. I love the turkey breast for all the Italian recipes, including a turkey parm. I love it that mm-hmm. way. And I keep the legs and thighs, unlike a lot of hunters. And you just got to know what to do with those. I find that you got to cook the turkey legs and thighs low and slow, because they're on their legs all day, every day. Domestic turkeys too, but so those muscles are tougher. They're using those muscles a lot more than they're using their breast muscles. And I love those in a couple of different applications. The turkey leg, if you cook low and slow, and then peel it off the bone, I love that for a lot of Mexican dishes, fajitas, tacos, anything that requires like a pulled type situation or pulled meat, works very well with a turkey leg. And then the thighs, I'll smoke the thighs and add them to our gumbos, which gives it an incredible flavor. But then again, you're braising it in a gumbo liquid, so you're breaking it down, which is what you have to do with turkey legs. Same thing with wings. You got to braise them and just break down that connective tissue and break down those really dense muscles. Other than that, if you try like frying a turkey leg, like you get at a carnival or something, you're going to be very, very disappointed in the product.
Yep. The Disneyland, like where you keep the meat on the bone, I know we can do it with domestic, but at the same time, there's not the density, or I would say that meat to tendon connection, how tight that is on a wild bird. You're just not going to be able to eat the meat off the leg and have an enjoyable experience. No. You're going to get those tendons are just not going to let go. So you are absolutely right when you said, like, in a shredded, pulled scenario, it's going to be great. Dark meat is my favorite. And the thigh, I feel, of the turkey offers not only the ease of having the most amount of turkey per bone weight ratio, but you only have one bone in that thigh that you have to worry about. I've gone sous vide with thighs and very much have enjoyed that. We'll slice those up. My wife she's been trying to change up how we do salads. And so she's been doing a lot with like arugula and really trying to get some more of the colored spinach in. And I find putting the a sous vide thigh that I've had on for, and again, it's going to be like 24 hours. It's going to be like 36 hours, a full day to 2 days, where then once it's all done like that, I can pull the bone out, slice it, and then at that point, lay those on top of the salad. And those have enough of a toothiness to them that they'll hold together and look nice on the plate. You can hit them with a fork, but they'd fall apart as you chew. So I like that balance in the toothiness of the dark meat, but at the same time, like, easy to eat on a salad.
Dry-aged steaks used to be a steakhouse-only indulgence. An old-world charcuterie was pricey due to being imported or created at a small batch-specific scale. Thanks to UmiDry, their synthetic dry-aging bags and casings allow you to create these meat-crafting treats in your own kitchen. Working in tandem with your fridge, the UmiDry bag material allows moisture and air to pass through, making it possible to dry-age large cuts of steaks or roasts. Paired with their curing and seasoning kits, along with safe and easy-to-follow instructions, salamis and dry sausage are well within your grasp. Use the link in the show notes and sign up for the newsletter to receive 10% off your order. UmiDry, helping us elevate our wild game from the home kitchen.
Hunters, listen up. If you're tired of struggling to hoist up your deer or big game after a successful hunt, it's time to upgrade to the Tyboss Blocking Tackle. With its self-locking mechanism, you can easily lift up to 300 pounds by yourself without the need to tie off to anything. Just pull the rope and it locks in place. Made in America and backed by a lifetime warranty, Tyboss is my go-to tool for all my hoisting and tying down needs. Check out the link in the show notes or head over to tyboss.com.
All
I agree. And listen, sous vide is, if you're a, you know, if you're interested in cooking wild game at all, you should really invest in a sous vide wand. Super simple, and it's like cheating. You know, it's a cheat code. You know, for everything. Yeah. Like you're saying, if you want to do a long cook on turkey legs, turkey thighs, great. If you want to get your venison backstrap right, perfect. I mean, and it, you know, it, you said it at 115 is what I do for backstrap, and it won't get over 115. I don't care how, you know, how long it stays in the bath. And then I just, you know, hit it on the cast iron to finish it off, and it turns out a perfect medium rare. It, I don't see why all wild game, you know, hunters don't have a sous vide.
Yep. I got mine two Christmases ago. I got it for Christmas, and I think, like, I, like, as we were going around, I think I saw the sticker label say like $90. So it was, you know, 2 years ago, it was under $100. Shoot. I bet if we go on to Amazon right now, you could get a sous vide wand for $50, and it's not the one that's going to be all like connect to your phone, and it's not going to have all the different settings, but at the same time, like, dude, give me the one with the buttons, and I just leave it and keep the water at the level. Bam. That's where that's at. All the extra little doohickeys, you don't need those on that
thing. You don't. Yeah. You're absolutely right. You don't need to spend the $400, you know, $400 on it. You're absolutely right with this, because they're all the same. It's just a wand that heats up water and keeps it at a constant temperature. That's all you need. You know, I don't need to turn on my sous vide wand, you know, from four states away with a Bluetooth feature. I just don't need that. But absolutely. And listen, you know, a good time to pick one up would be the Black Friday sales. You've harvested a deer or two already, and you know, you've got some meat coming in. Perfect time for it. 100%. Between that and a vacuum sealer, you know, of course you would absolutely need a vacuum sealer for the sous vide, but, you know, I don't see how, you know, an avid outdoorsman gets away without a vacuum sealer, a sous vide, and a meat grinder. Honestly, you know, we grind all of our own meat. I don't see how people don't do that. You know, and we're crazy. You know, we'll spend $4,000 on a rifle and $3,000 on a scope, and we'll spend, you know, $4,000 on a designer camouflage, but we're not going to spend $200 on a grinder. You know, I just don't understand.
No, can't do that. Yeah, I'm not going to use it as much as I would my, you know, Benelli, or as much as my new Matthews, you know, whatever weight bow.
Yeah.
It's, yep, kind of lost track with that. I laugh at that same thing. I went ahead and got the big grinder. And a bunch of my buddies in our group have really kind of like, they stepped up with different pieces of equipment. We got a sausage stuffer now, so we feel like we've gotten all the pieces. The one went and got a dehydrator, but now it's all in my shop, and I've got an area where all this stuff is. And so it's like when jerky day comes around for somebody, they're like, I'm out of jerky. Like two or three guys will be like, all right, I'll get my stuff together real quick, and we'll batch it all up. But to be able to get the stuff that we want to be able to, yeah, it was like group effort here. Everybody get in, everybody chip in. But yeah, to do life without that, we've gotten into batch cooking where if I'll do shanks, like I want to be a big thing of shredded shanks, or I want to make barbacoa or whatever I'm trying to make, I'm going to throw 6 to 8 shanks in there and make it a full batch, make it worthwhile my time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've got the vacuum sealer, you know, I'm stuffing bags, I'm weighing them out to a pound or a pound and a half, and then those are going in the freezer at that point, because there's going to be a time when sports hit, we're going to want to come home, and, you know, there's just, we're not going to stop at every McDonald's along the way. We're going to have to be able to cook meals on a whim, on a quick, and if I want something that has been low and slow, it's going to take a long time to have some put up, frozen up, or shoot, even burritos when school starts again this next term, to have a whole bunch of burritos set up for lunches, man, that's the savior right there. It's either I'm going to eat crap or I'm going to have one of those burritos. So yeah, setting myself up for success and continuing to eat my wild game throughout the year has to take that pre-planning.
Yep. And we do the same thing. I just made a batch of wild duck chorizo. And I used my vacuum sealer and froze them in what I, you know, what I think are the appropriate portions for a stuffed potato or Mexican cornbread with wild duck chorizo, or, you know, just pull out a pack to, you know, mix with my scrambled eggs. So just in that regard, I mean, I just find that, and then it does a really good job of protecting your game in the freezer. So, and on yes. top of that, it does a really good job of defrosting when you need it, because it doesn't take nearly as long to defrost it. So it's a special tool, honestly. And like you said, you know, for those, you know, hectic weekdays, I can just pull out a portion, and you don't, it doesn't have to be wild game. You know, it could be the lasagna that you had left over, and just do it in you know, individual servings, and you've got, you know, a great meal nearly instantly. I don't know why any, I just don't, for the life of me, I don't understand why people don't do it.
Well, it takes forward thought. It takes a little, it takes pre-planning, and it takes effort, Jason. And I find that effort nowadays, I don't know, just with my students, sometimes it's hard to find that effort. Everything is pulling at our attention, and you know, it's, you don't have time to commit to something, but when it's really that important, when it comes down to like, okay, what are things that I am going to commit to? This has got to be one of those things. I got to make sure that I'm putting good food on my family's table. Even if we're running away from the table, even if we're running past the table, it's going to be something good on that table.
We are in the same camp, my man.
Well, I'm still a little bit on my own hog high right now. And I know you were talking that, you know, you just this past term with your, with your co-op, you guys took out 300 hogs on one of those properties. That is a lot of hogs on that. Louisiana is just inundated. I'm sure of it. Me as a Yankee, as a Northerner, we come down and we claim to be helping. We claim to be, you know, I'm helping out one property. I'm helping out my one buddy in Oklahoma. And we did our fair share. We got 15, you know, but at the same time, like the numbers that you look at, you're like, oh, you guys haven't even scratched the surface. But the ability to go down, and I would say the seasonality of these pigs, because you've got a couple photos of yourself sitting there with a couple pigs. You've already were saying like, well, I'm going to do this with the ham, and I'm going to do this with some sausage. Like, these pigs, there's a time to shoot them, and then there's a time to shoot and take and keep, and then there's a time to just get rid of based upon the environment. In Louisiana, do you find that there is a prime time where you're getting the fattest feral pigs, and is there a time when you're finding that these things are just eking on survival, that fat cap just isn't there?
I don't think that's what I'm looking for as much, Nick, is that, you know, you'll spend an evening shooting pigs. And if you're doing it in July when it's 90 degrees when the sun sets, and you throw a dead sow in the back of your side-by-side and you ride around with her for 5 or 6 hours looking for other pigs, you know, I don't think you're going to be very happy with the pork. And on top of that, you know, when you stop to clean a pig at night, the mosquitoes and the bugs are just horrendous. So, you know, the pigs that I keep are normally early fall, and we'll do this right before the deer season, because you don't want to be riding around at night. You know, we're deer hunters. We want to see deer. But the absolute best time is around March. It's still cool outside. There's plenty of pigs out there. They've probably, you know, gone through everybody's corn feeder down here, and they're all corn fed and just fat and happy. And it's a pleasure to clean 4 or 5 hogs in a night. The meat doesn't spoil. You're not having to contend with the bugs. It's getting a little late in the season now, but March, and then right after turkey season again in May, is when we really do our damage with the thermal rifles, with the thermal scopes on top of a rifle. But oddly enough, so, we just had that trip maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and my buddy's driving a side-by-side, and he's using the green light on his headlamp to make sure we don't hit anything, which is still very difficult to see. And I'm using the thermal, and we're riding around looking for pigs, and we're putting a number on them. At this point, we probably got, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 hogs on the ground. And we come around the corner, and with a thermal, I don't know if you've ever had, you have any experience with a thermal at all, but you're, when you come around the corner, you're looking at a silhouette of an animal. So you got to identify the silhouette, and there's no depth perception. So a raccoon at 20 feet looks like a pig at 200 yards. So you're kind of trying to figure this out, you know, very quickly. So we come around the corner and
armadillos. That was, I would freak out at every armadillo. I'd bang on the driver's seat to slow down. We'd put four, everybody's got all their thermals looking at it. And they're like, Nick gets an armadillo and he's right there. Yeah. But like everyone.
So we come around the corner and there's this blob of a pig. And I'm like, stop. Cause it's very difficult to shoot a, you know, shoot it from a moving vehicle. And he stops and I look at it and Nick, I had pressure on the trigger and I was getting ready to put some rounds into this pig. And then it turned and looked at me and I realized, oh, it's a bear. So we'd ridden up on a bear, which obviously is not legal to shoot at this time.
No.
So I was nearly having to have a conversation with a wildlife and fisheries officer about how I thought this bear was a pig. But thank God I didn't finish that trip.
Thank heavens you, yeah, every guy's second opinion. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
So it was, you know, the first time I had, you know, I've seen bears in Louisiana, but I've never seen one through a thermal while I was hunting for something similar in size. It was a very interesting encounter.
Oh, great. So the pigs you've kept, does size really matter to you?
Yes.
Because at least on my trips going to Oklahoma, I mean, some of the big sow that I got this year, I mean, she was tipping the scale at 200 pounds. And the fat cap on her, I mean, shoot, we're looking at an inch to an inch and a quarter, just fat cap on the outside. And between her meat and a young boar that I've had, like I couldn't tell the difference. Like it was all very mild. And that's where I was attributing to maybe that it was because, again, all of our trips seem to go down in March, is that everything's just plump and living on the high life there. They got so much water. They got so much grub and feed to go after. It's like, it seems to be like everything tastes good at that point where they haven't been really tested or really been, you know, droughted out or been chased around a ton to have that flavor difference. But it sounds to me like you've got a specific pig in mind that when you put them up in the sights and you take one out, you're like, yep, that one is a specific keeper for a number of reasons.
Okay. So what I was saying is that when you shoot that many pigs, you can be extremely selective. And I'm looking for that sow that's like 100 to 120, 140 pounds, and it produces a ton of meat. The quality of the meat is phenomenal. A lot of people like to say, oh, you should have kept that 10 or 15 pound piglet. They are a pain to clean. Their hide is thick like a pig hide, but they're so tender on the inside that you really, when you're trying to skin them, you're yanking them, you know, apart. You know, it's very barbaric, but you're yanking them apart, and it's hard to get a good clean, whole pig without just totally destroying it. And, you know, believe it or not, there's just not a lot of pork on a 15 pound piglet. You know, everybody, oh, just put the whole thing on a pit and whatnot. There's just not a lot of pig on that. You know, once you take the hide and the head and the innards out, you know, you've got 3 pounds of, you know, of pork and with bone in it. And like, man, if I wanted chicken, I just buy chicken.
I did that one 4th of July. It was our first trip down. We ended up getting two, and these were a little bit bigger than the 10 to 15s. These were like the 20, 25 pounders. And I did, I put those on a pellet grill, but I kept head on, skin on. I torched all the pigs before we came home. And so it was right there at the skin. So I was kind of wanting to do one of those whole hog where you peel the skin off and then get to the meat on the underside. Because of what you were just saying, like I did, I peeled the skin off and the meat was already so tender. I ended up just shredding it all anyways. Absolutely incredible, succulent meat. But at the same time, that the ROI on that, the return on investment, was a little bit shy of what I was looking for.
Exactly. That, and that's why I like that 100-pound variety, because you get a ton of meat still, and it's worth the effort. You know, it takes you half hour, 45 minutes to clean the whole thing, and the ROI on that is much better. You know, a lot of people turn their nose up to the boars. They're fine. You know, you can tell if a boar, you know, you walk up to it and you can smell it before you see it. You know, you might throw that to the alligators. But if you walk up to a boar and, you know, the testicles hadn't even dropped yet, it's probably a pretty good pig. But, you know, if you're going to shoot one pig, you know, incidentally, here in Louisiana, you're deer hunting, a pig walks out, you shoot it, and it's an 80-pound boar, clean it. It's a good pig. But, you know, if you're going to shoot 25 a night, you know, just be selective. What do you want? You know, the instance where we actually trapped or killed 313 on our property, man, I would love to give all of that away, but that's just not, you know, it's not feasible. I wish the homeless shelters would take it, but the FDA won't let them take an animal that's been, you know, harvested that way, which is unfortunate, because we're throwing away a ton of good pork that could go to something other than the alligators and the buzzards. But, you know, Uncle Sam just doesn't want anybody to be efficient, I guess.
Right, right. And that is such a hard sticking point. We've got a couple different, like Hunters Against Hunger. I know there was, there's another one started up, and basically trying to be an avenue for wild game to get to these food banks. And, but at the same time, it has to go through a facility. And I get that they want to be able to dot their I's and cross their T's, but at the same time, it's like, man, there is such a bounty here that could be shared. And it feels like it's just red tape right now getting in the way. Like we've got a solution. We've got a solution to a really big issue here in America, being hunger or these areas of just food deserts. Why not we use this amazing product that you and I enjoy on the daily to be able to have that over there? But because it doesn't harvest it the way that they'd like it to be done in a facility, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, and maybe somebody smarter than myself can figure this out in the future and we can, you know, solve some of those issues. But, you know, some of the laws that are on the books are just absolutely ludicrous. Did you know in Louisiana, there is a law that you and I can't barter game. So if I've got a bunch of fish and you've got some venison, you and I can't legally trade it. You know, could you imagine?
Because it's a value. You're putting a value on something that should not have value. I think Michigan's the same way. Now, I can gift you, you know, a bunch of whitefish from Michigan. You know, out of the goodness of my heart, I can give that to you. And now at the same time. You could feel the spirit move inside you and you could gift me, you know, some of that wild, delicious pork down there. But you're right. As soon as we start to like, you know, come to a deal, oh, well, then it's all said and done.
Nick, could you imagine our forefathers coming alive right now and saying, what do you mean I can't trade venison for fish? Could you imagine that?
Yeah, they would. There's a lot of things that I feel like my forefathers would shake their heads at, and this is definitely would be one of them. Oh my goodness!
So enjoying the pork thing. Oh. I'm sorry. Saying I enjoy the pork thing, but at this point, it's getting a little warm in the season. Where you know, at night, I just want to enjoy the air conditioning.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not quite there yet. We're still, yeah. Well, I think we right now we're into the 70s now. We went from 60s into 70s. So it's a hot day today for us, comparatively. One thing I want to leave us on is when you're getting your pork, and you're making sausage with that pork, are you adding fat cap to that, or are you just using straight, like, let's say you're using the butt. Are you adding any additional fat to that, or are you just using the butt as is and that's a good enough mixture with the marbling?
So I've done it both ways. My preference is to add domesticated pork fat to the wild fat, because they're just not that fat. You know, they're fatter than a deer. They're about the fattest creature that I'll shoot in Louisiana, but they're still don't have the intramuscular fat that wild pork does. They don't have the exterior fat that wild pork does. And that's why you really don't see a whole bunch of people making wild pork bacon. It's just not there. So to answer your question, I've done it both ways. I've actually mixed wild pork and wild venison and sausage. And it comes out a tad bit on the dry side. It's better than just straight venison. But you know, my favorite type is probably 80% wild pork, 20% domesticated pork. I find that makes it a good, you know, a good blend, something that I'm very pleased with the product. And with that, some of my favorites are Italian sausage, which you can, you know, Google the ingredients you need, all the seasonings you need for Italian sausage, or even a breakfast sausage. And I don't actually make those into links. I'll keep those separate as loose meat. And I'll just form a breakfast sausage patty when I'm ready to use it. And then for the Italian sausage, that's what all my spaghettis and lasagnas and all my Italian dishes, I'll go to the loose meat Italian sausage blend. And, you know,
yeah,
if you came over for supper and I gave you this wild pork lasagna, you'd have no clue.
Well, here's the thing. I would be expecting the wild pork. I would be a little upset if all of a sudden it says Stouffer's, you know, a pack of Stouffer's is peeking out of the trash. I'd be like, Jason, what the heck is this?
Exactly.
Well, Jason, this has been an awesome hour. I do got to wrap us up. I have enjoyed so much our conversation. You've got a website that you're working on, and you've got a blog that you've been putting a lot of recipes out for. Where can my listeners, again, follow along with you?
Edible Outdoors Cook is everything. Website, Instagram, and Facebook. That's how you reach me. And I have a whole bunch of people that will DM me throughout the day and ask me various cooking questions or whatever. I try to get back to everybody within, you know, that day. Sometimes it doesn't happen, but 95% of everybody who asks me a question, I'll shut down what I'm doing because I prefer talking about that than doing my 8-to-5 job. I don't mind having conversations with like-minded people. I love it, as a matter of fact. Now, if you're going to call me and tell me that, or send me a message and tell me that, you know, I shouldn't be hunting, I should be getting my food from the grocery store, I'll block you and shut you down because I just don't have the time for nonsense. But, you know, if you want to have a good conversation with like-minded people, I'm here for you.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, hey, folks, be sure to check out Jason's website because this man knows what he's talking about. He's putting high-quality food on his table, not just at one season, not just being an avenue of one species, but being a true outdoorsman. Going through the different species, getting whatever his property is asking for him to take off, or at that time when the season opens, he's being able to harvest that bounty and then use that for his family. So folks, whether it's you going to be going out and finally doing something with that turkey that's been sitting in your freezer for a couple weeks and trying to really get after those legs and thighs, or it's going to be tapping into that venison that's also been sitting in that freezer all winter, and now something needs to happen to it. Make sure that the knife that you are using on those critters is very sharp.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use, helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/N365Copilot.
Chronic migraine, 15 or more headache days a month, each lasting 4 hours or more, can make me feel like a spectator in my own life.
Botox, onabotulinum toxin A, prevents headaches in adults with chronic migraine. It's not for those with 14 or fewer headache days a month. It's the number one prescribed branded chronic migraine preventive treatment.
Prescription Botox is injected by your doctor. Effects of Botox may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness can be signs of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Side effects may include allergic reactions, neck and injection site pain, fatigue, and headache. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Don't receive Botox if there's a skin infection. Tell your doctor your medical history, muscle or nerve conditions, including ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis or Lambert-Eaton syndrome, and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects.
Why wait? Ask your doctor, visit BotoxChronicMigraine.com, or call 1-800-44-BOTOX to learn more.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.